This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
All this has got to be an animal, right?
No animal I've ever seen.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematica Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are looking at the newly released small-town horror flick Antlers, meant to come out in the middle of 2020, delayed until, two, three weeks ago?
Wasn't it late 2019?
2019? Jesus Christ.
Maybe that's when I was first heard about it.
This is so weird. It's so weird watching movies these days and just wondering when it was filmed. Does anybody else do that?
I do ever since I learned that World War Z was finished in like 2009 or 2007. It came out 6 or 7 years later. Like it was Jesus just on the cutting Christ. Room for 4 years.
Yeah. For me, it's like Corona. Like I watch a film and I think, what restrictions did they have to take? Are those people in different rooms because they couldn't like bring them into the same room at the same time? The Tig Notaro thing in Army of the Dead was fascinating, that she was immune compromised and they could only get one person. Anyway, fuck, it doesn't matter. Who cares? We'll go over some news first, our thoughts, and then get stuck into the science that this movie brings up, including cannibalism, parasites, and antlers, and why one of those three things is not as bad for you as I previously thought it was. I mean, yeah, physically, not morally. Morally, it's still pretty bad for you. As always, this show's broken up into those segments, and there's time codes below, so if you're really jonesing for some cannibalism news, just skip straight ahead, you know? But before we get into that, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside co-host Adam Harsick, a disease ecologist at the Ben-Gurion University of the... Oh, I was going to pronounce it correctly today and I've forgotten how to pronounce Negev. Negev?
It's a very Negev. Dramatic pause. I liked it.
Yeah. Alongside Adam is the Baroness... Ladyship Libby Young.
Ladies and gentlemen, Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
He even had the cigar in his mouth for that. That was weird.
Now, Dave, we were talking about something with antlers today, and Dave had a horrifying reaction. You know, you can't denigrate a moose in the kind of way that this movie does, so he refused to appear on this podcast.
See, I actually thought he heard of a two separate areas of Canada. One was pronouncing it Wendigo, and the other was pronouncing it Wendigo, so he went out to correct the incorrect one.
Yeah. Speaking of moose, I don't know if anybody's seen this, but in terms of news this week, there was a picture of a Russian family that was just hanging around a young male moose and just, like, you know, feeding it food.
Great idea.
Yeah, great idea. And all of they were surprised when it kicked their daughter in the face.
What?
Oh,
yeah. Is she okay? She was fine afterwards, but everybody got really shocked. Yeah, like, habituated wild animals, it's not a good thing to happen. You should not habituate wild animals like that. Moose are extremely dangerous.
One of the most dangerous animals.
Yeah, especially in North America, where they're much larger than over here in Europe, but... Still over here in Europe, you do not fuck around with meese or, you know, just cervids in general, apart from maybe a pika or a dick dick. You could probably get away with that, but not a pika. What am I thinking of?
Puku? Puku deer?
Puku, yeah. You could probably get away with, you know, messing around with a puku.
So in Oregon news, earlier this year, 8 wolves were poisoned. And after thorough investigations, the police are saying... We don't fucking know what happened. Please help. So they have sort of opened up the investigation to the public to find out who has poisoned 8 beautiful wolves in the eastern part of the state.
Enforcement of these sort of laws are really hard. Like, we have quite strict laws about moving fish species from lake to lake in Norway. Because obviously, you know, it can fuck entire ecosystems up, keep invasive species out of your ecosystems. But... It's incredibly hard to enforce those laws. Like, how do you find out who put a fish in there?
Exactly.
You ask them.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm assuming that the poison that they use to do in the wolves is going to be readily available at local hardware stores.
Stock standard. So, yeah.
You can get poison, firearms, anything. at Walmart.
Mm. Yeah. I think the only thing that you can do is kind of what they're doing, which is opening up to the public, and a lot of conservation groups are offering rewards. So like right now, currently for the Oregon wolves, there is a $26,000 reward. So that, I think, incentivizes maybe to turn on your neighbor if you've heard something. But other than that, like, I don't know how you would catch somebody.
Yeah.
Or prove it.
It's a pain in the ass.
Leave the wolves alone. We need them.
Yeah.
Lucky for us, wolves are afraid of people and they'll almost never attack humans. But when we breed them with dogs, that's when it gets crucial. Wolf dogs are much more aggressive and they actually will step to people. And if you try to come at him with a rolled up newspaper, he'll just put your face on one.
All right, summary for this week. We obviously did the movie Antlers. And this week's summary is underdeveloped, much like the narrative themes of this movie. Good dad / meth lab owner turns First Nations lore into reality by Wendigoing the bad luck lottery and catching the newest COVID variant and getting one of his two sons infected in the process. They both den up in their house, leaving their poor 12-year-old son to be the primary caregiver to their carnivorous demands. The overly caring and weirdly traumatized teacher uses the trauma force to sense the damaged midichlorians in young Lucas. She ropes in the principal.
Midichlorians, my God.
She ropes in the principal, who is the real hero of this movie, for getting the whole movie fucking started by opening the goddamn door.
Oh my God.
The monsters escape. The principal dies. Other people die. The teacher and the film protagonist uses the power of plot armor to battle an enormous monster with her combined of zero strength and zero combat skill to kill the creature and walk away with minimal scratches. But bad Buck Chuck has the last laugh by infecting her brother, so the lore continues. Dun dun dun.
What do we like about this movie?
I think for me, unlike at least one of my co-hosts, I enjoyed the slower pace of this movie. I think it did a really good job of kind of setting up the atmosphere of this pretty desolate, sad town. It also helped that I had a really shitty stream to watch this on, so it really looked shitty to me. I really enjoyed the creature itself. I thought it was a super cool design, and it was more than a little frightening to see those kind of shapes and the kind of movement and power that it had.
I feel this is another one of those movies that we've had a bunch of this season, where it's kind of a mediocre plot, but helped by a really cool setting. I love that whole sense of, even if, you know, this does turn out all right, they've still got to go back to this shithole of a town and keep living their lives in this just despair-filled pit of misery. I liked Kerry Russell and Jesse Plemons, especially Jesse Plemons just looks so weary in this movie. It's like he cannot stand.
Haggard as fuck.
Small town sheriff ass vibes.
And all this stuff is happening around him, all this horrifying shit, and he's just like, oh, it's not worse than meth labs. Like,
I think the best part of this movie, to your point, was basically when she was telling him you didn't have to run for sheriff, and he was like, well, no one else fucking wanted it.
Yeah.
Like, in most movies, like, it's always like the race to see who can, you know, win the position, and it's like a sought after job title, and this town is so fucking desolate that nobody wants it.
That really hit home when he's talking about, I've got to go and evict another family with kids from their house because they can't pay rent or anything like that. I was like, yeah, this fucking sucks. And it's weird because I didn't like the slow pace of the movie because it's a horror movie and I'm expecting something to happen a bit faster. But I kind of wanted to see more of this town. I think this would have really worked well as a season of the terror.
I could see that.
Yeah, maybe.
I really liked something oddly specific about this movie. I really, really liked the usage of the embers in the creature. I thought the final scene where she cuts out his or its heart, and the whole thing is just like fucking piping hot, and she like drops it because of the heat. I don't know why. I just thought that was a really cool take on something, you know, done to death. Could have been just a gore fest and blood shooting out everywhere, but they chose to sort of almost make it a little bit more magical because this creature was based out of magic, I think. So I really like
that. Actually, on that note, I want to add one more thing that I liked, is that when, you know, the creature's down, She doesn't mess around like so many people or turn her back like so many people in horror movie do. She grabs a knife and she just stabs the fuck out of it to make sure that thing stays down.
Cutting his fucking heart out.
Yeah. That was great. I enjoyed that bit.
It really was.
Though her flipping that whole body over was very unrealistic. Yeah. She'd been doing some buff teacher workouts.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, she's got to motivate that fucking class with something. Yeah. Hey, kids.
With her guns.
Check this shit out. Just flex at them.
Like, I did like as well, like, when that creature dies and immediately the little kid starts screaming, the look on her face just like, fuck, are hell, I guess me? I gotta go and do this as well then.
I guess I gotta kill a child.
Gets up, she's like, I guess, you know, teacher of the fucking year here. What didn't we like about this?
Minus the really cool, I thought it was a really cool reveal of the fucking dude's dad's face just on this monster still because it hasn't fully stretched out. That was horrendous in a good way.
Yeah.
But that whole last scene was so anticlimactic and unenjoyable for me. It's just like, I'm just going to stand up and swipe in the air with my big monster hands. And then, yeah. Oh, look at this convenient piece of rebar. Let me just stab you with this with my... I am a useless teacher. Like, make her a cop. Make her the sheriff and have some kind of combat experience. Like, come on. Not this fucking, oh, my brother is, you know, the sheriff of the town is been stabbed through the arm, through the shoulder, been thrown around, and I'm, like, trying to bandage him up. Let me pick him up by his injured arm and say, you need a hospital, but I'm going to drive you to this coal mine instead, and then we're just going to leave you in the car. Well, you're probably going to bleed to death, so good luck.
Nah,
but
I'm going to
go save this kid. Fuck off.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, to Adam's point, I get really annoyed a lot of the time when people are going on about, oh, you know, why is this bloody skinny girl doing action scenes? She looks like she'd snap like a twig or something like that. Because I'm like, it's a fucking action movie. Like, get over it. None of these people would be able to do any of this sort of shit. Who cares? Doesn't matter. But this, so I don't know why this pissed me off so much. Like, this enormous creature bearing down there and she's just like, stabs it with a pole and it's okay. I don't know what sort of line this crossed, but I was just like, nah, I don't.
Also, that wasn't what killed it. Fucking Lucas uses like a pocket knife in its shin. Like, where did he stab it? And it just goes down like a sack of potatoes. Like, what did this kid use?
And also, like, this is a 95-minute movie, but it is slow in places. My God.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I would have liked that if we were building like more characters and you were getting to know more parts of the town. Like I said, if it was a season of the terror, but because it's a horror and I just kind of wanted to see the monster, it felt very, very slow at times. And they are trapped in that room for a long fucking time.
Yeah, I'm with Sam on this one. This was a snooze fest. It was, I timed it 49 minutes before the action starts kicking off. That's a long-ass time for some exposition that you don't really need. I actually made a note that I felt, kind of to Adam's point, this felt like a bad 80s monster movie. Like, they had the classic scene, like, in the shed where it's, like, half hidden by the barn, and it's, like, reaching over, and, like, you can't see it, and it just looked like, did you have the budget to make this? Because you're cutting a lot of corners, and it's pretty obvious for 2020 or 2021.
Yeah.
I felt, too, like the protagonist. The entire movie is based off the First Nations lore of the Wendigo. And it felt like an afterthought. I think it would have been cool to have the teacher have, even though I like Kiri Russell, I think she's great, I think it would have been really cool to have her actually be from the First Nations and sort of remember that lore from her childhood, sort of like Pumpkinhead, where Ed Hardy has this memory of like Pumpkinhead and like that lore based around the area that he lived in. And so for her to sort of have that knowledge and use that knowledge and that storytelling thread throughout the movie to help her fight this creature rather than just like the token First Nations guy explaining to the white people what it is, and then he just fucks off for the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
So I think that would have been like a much better way to incorporate that.
Libby, I just want to point out, you said Ed Hardy. It's actually pronounced Ed Hardy.
Ed Hardy. Why did I say Ed Hardy?
So yeah, I'm just, to Libby's point, I think that I knew this monster was some kind of, like, big beast with antlers, because the fucking title. But I think, you know, about three quarters of the way through the movie when the sheriff, when the old sheriff is like, yeah, Wendigo, I was like, come fucking on. Like, that was not a reveal I liked at all. Mm. And I thought it was very ham-fisted and very poorly done. It's just not appropriate, I feel like, for this.
Yeah.
Also, one last point. I think it would have been much more fascinating when, in the final battle, she's just blind firing in the cave for her to accidentally shoot Lucas. She is popping off rounds like nobody's business with two children. Ricocheting.
Yeah. They're all deaf now.
God.
What do we got for trivia then?
Well, this is based off of a short story called The Quiet Boy, originally published in Guernica magazine from the author Nick Antosca. Nick Antosca. Hope I'm saying that right. So actually, Adam and I both read the short story before we watched this. And I gotta say, I like the short story better.
I think if they hadn't made this a weird, like, Wendigo shoehorning, I would have thought this was a really cool and creative way to kind of expand past what was a very short story into a, you know, a feature-length film. But it's similar enough that you can kind of see the roots, but it's also different enough that it's not the best adaptation.
Yeah. In a way. That's a shame, because, I mean, more short stories should be adapted into movies as opposed to, like, fucking full-length books. I mean, we talked about Frozen Hell and The Thing earlier this season, where you have the bones of a story in 80 pages. That's a chance. That's somewhere where you can actually fit all of those 80 pages and then expand on that in a movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas you can't do that with a fucking 400-page novel.
This is a very dumb trivia, but this is the third time Jesse Plemons has played the role of sheriff for a movie.
Really?
Yeah.
What has he been sheriff in?
He has been sheriff in American Made, and that was a 2017 movie, and a 2018 movie called Game Night.
I'm too old for this shit.
So, before we start looking at the science today, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can always get in touch with Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can also chat again with us on Discord. Just type in Cinematica Animalia and you'll find us. If you want to read Libby's work, as always, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And if you want to hear about more of the less movie-related ecology that Adam, myself, and a massive team of writers write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. So a mainstay of Wendigo folklore is the consumption of human flesh, which triggers the transformation or possession of a person by the Wendigo's spirit, or triggers a transformation into a Wendigo, depending on what version of folklore you're reading. Mine is straight out of Supernatural, so probably not the most reliable source.
That documentary? Supernatural?
Yeah, the documentary that went for 20 seasons of documentary by Jared Padalecki and Dean.
Jensen Ackles.
Yeah, Jensen Ackles, there we go. Yeah, I thought, before I went into this movie and did some research afterwards, that eating humans was a real problem. Like, it's very, very bad for you. Turns out it's not. I mean, again, health-wise, I mean, not, you know, don't do that
not
shit.
Soul-wise.
Don't be a Jeffrey Dahmer, start eating people.
Yeah, just don't do it, please. And if you're going to do it, don't come near me afterwards. Or beforehand. Or why? Or during. Just in general, don't. But yeah, it's not that bad for you. Like, as long as the meat is cooked, you're fine.
Yeah.
Except for the brain. Yeah. The reason you have to stay away from the brain is because the brain contains a type of glycoprotein called prions. A buildup of prions in your system can result in a disease called kuru. Kuru is, and I quote from the Medical News Today article here, a unanimously fatal, fancy way of saying it's going to kill you every fucking time. It's going to get you. Transmissible spongiform encephalopathy. It's similar to mad cow disease, basically.
Makes your brain mush.
Yeah, it's fucking horrible. And the only people who have experienced it, who have experienced a documented epidemic of kuru, are the four people Now, the four people come from Papua New Guinea. They're an indigenous group from Papua New Guinea. And they, until recently, practiced the consumption of a relative's flesh once they've died to keep that kind of, to keep them in the family, keep them as a part of you.
Ritualistic cannibalism.
Yeah. Kuru comes from the four language and means to shake as a result of some of the symptoms that happen to these people. These are the symptoms of Kuru. So there's the first stage, which is headaches, joint pain, shaking, loss of balance, deterioration of speech. The sedentary stage, so the second stage, the victim becomes incapable of walking, loss of muscle coordination, severe tremors. And then the terminal stage is you cannot sit without being supported. You have virtually no muscle coordination whatsoever, unable to speak, rampant incontinence, unresponsive to your surroundings, and ulcerations with pus and necrosis. So, yeah, it's
absolutely horrifying.
It's real bad. Yeah. And this is from consumption of the brain. It can also actually stay in the system for a long, long time. Like, a Kuru can be dormant in your system for up to 50 years, apparently, which is just...
Jeez.
Yeah, luckily it's not transmissible between people apart from the consumption of the brain. So it's not something that can get passed on really easily. But yeah, horrifying disease.
From my understanding too, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in that sort of first stage, there's a little bit of a Chasha's hideous laughter going on. And I think people sort of become like delirious and supposedly laugh a lot. So it's like also a sign.
Yeah, mental instability is a... it's also called laughing sickness because of that.
There you go.
Yeah.
I think my my fun fact about that is that the four people have enjoyed this custom of consuming the brains of their relatives. I think specifically the women and children are the ones who consume the brains in these ceremonies. Problem-free until fucking European came along that had prions in his brain. And when he died, they consumed his brain, I believe. And now it's in their population.
And shout outs to Tim Newman for that fantastic article on Kuru and cannibalism. It was really interesting. Yeah, because like I said, I thought that cannibalism in general could lead to build-up of really problematic parasites and that sort of thing in other humans. But yeah, apparently not.
It's one of those interesting things where I've seen quite a bit of debate about it in the parasite literature as far as if cannibalism is good or bad for parasites, in the sense that cannibalism, it could be bad if you're eating diseased tissue or tissue with, you know, bacteria, viruses, other parasites, and then you're going to be infecting yourself. But it could also be bad for the parasite and good for the population, quote, quote, in the sense that if you have a parasite that is horizontally transmitted, so one that can go from one host to another just by contact or any kind of contamination, if a cannibal eats the infected individual, they are usually removing those infective stages from the environment and they can't spread anymore. So it goes from potentially infecting just one to even zero there, because if you need to like touch or drill through the skin of, you know, your next host and somebody eats you, you're going to be digested. You can't infect anybody else. So it stops transmission cold. But fun little anecdote I have about cannibalism that I remember reading on Reddit about 2 years ago. There was a guy who had a bet with his friend, or like a deal with his friend, of if they ever had the opportunity, they would try to eat human flesh. Legally, you know, ethically, or whatever, however you want to call it. And for one reason or another, he had to have his foot amputated. And he talked to his friend about it, and he's like, hey, so I asked the doctor, and like, they said I could have the foot. Do you want to cook this up? And so basically they made like soft shell tacos out of like his foot meat.
Oh. Of all the parts
it's for some reason it's the foot that's freaking me out here.
Same. It's not the human flesh, it's the foot flesh.
Anyway, speaking of parasites.
Yeah, so we touched on this briefly last week with Scott talking about parasitoid wasps and the kind of organisms that will burrow inside of you and then eventually come out as a new fully formed organism. We see this in aliens, we see this in parasitoid wasps. There are a number of other organisms that do this. Many of them are wasps, and fun fact, parasitoid wasps are one of the most species-rich groups of organisms on the planet. There's really? So fucking many of them. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. There's a fuck ton of them. They're also beautiful, if you ever get a chance to see them. There's one that's at least, I don't know how all over the North America it is, but it's called the cuckoo wasp. It is this bright, like, turquoise, emerald-esque, like, wasp. Libby and I saw one of those at our yard sale. It was adorable.
It's beautiful. But, I was going to say, just to interrupt quick, we do have a lot of diverse and not so diverse parasitoid wasps here in the South, as in all capital wasps.
Yeah. white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, for those of you who don't know. Part of the, and Libby's going to touch on this a bit more later, but one aspect of the Wendigo folklore is that it's passed from one individual to another. And this can be just because the spirit moves from one person to another, or if somebody consumes human flesh, they can become possessed by the spirit. I don't know if what the mechanism is for that in the folklore, if it's something about like opening a door, or if it's just a manifestation due to your actions. But in the movie, we see it clearly that there is, well, I didn't see it clearly because the stream I was watching, it was quote-quote legal. The person who was quote-quote getting the stream for us had hidden the camera during the pivotal scene at the very beginning of the movie in the mine. So I'm not quite sure what happened as far as, did a monster jump out at them? Was it a person? I don't know. But we do know that the dad ended up infected. And the youngest son, unfortunately, also got infected.
Yeah.
And we know from the end, Jesse Plemons, the tired-ass sheriff, becomes infected as well. And it goes through a sequence of stages, much like an Alien, where there's a dormant part, and then it eventually takes over the entire body. We see the dad losing his hair. He's getting paler. He is very strange. He's weak. Talking about emaciated. Earlier. He's very emaciated, but he's also eating dead animals and seems to be totally fine with it. And I think, to me, the saddest part of it was, when we get a little flashback for Lucas, that the dad is clearly aware there's something very bad going on with him, and he's trying to keep himself away from his kids, which I thought was heartbreaking, and a really nice bit of humanity kind of put into the movie there.
Yeah.
As far as it's operating in nature, there's a lot of evidence for it. There's parasitoids all over the place. As far as this operating with a kind of organism sprouting from the body of another one and completely opening them like the husk of an onion and becoming this gigantic 3-4 meter tall, 9-12 foot tall monster out of a very emaciated meth head, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Maybe a much smaller creature. I mean, like a Jabberwocky, if you're familiar with those. Libby, what's the rabbit with the antlers?
Oh!
Jackalope!
Yeah, there we go.
Jackalope. Yeah, so maybe if we have a jackalope-type creature, so a creature the size of a rabbit with deer antlers popping out of the chest of a human, I think that's much more likely if we're going to have this kind of life cycle evolve. I don't have any kind of mechanism whereby this evolutionary history would come by a parasitoid mammal with antlers that becomes a massive predator. It's fascinating. I would love to try to figure that out, but I have nothing for that, unfortunately.
But I will say that this isn't as extreme a change in size as we see in Alien and Aliens, where you have something tiny slither out of the chest and then all of a sudden just grow big out of nowhere. Like, we see this creature eat a lot or, increase the consumption of its host, at least, break out. We don't know how big it is when it does break out of the human, and we see
it's smaller. When it kills the bully, it's clearly a much smaller creature, maybe man-sized, but it's not quite full-grown, like, end scene monster-sized.
Yeah, and we see it grow, very quickly. So, in that sense, that's a more realistic aspect of it than the xenomorph and aliens, for sure.
Whatever it was big, and it's using the antlers to move around.
Lastly, before we turn over to Libby, this movie is called Antlers, so I want to ruminate on antlers and what they are for a little bit, because they grow insanely fast in this, of course. Like, you see antlers sprouting out of that guy's mouth, which was a really cool visual, I thought.
Horrifying.
Yeah, very, very grotesque. Now, antlers do grow really fast. They're one of the fastest growing organs in the entire world, because they are actually organs. So, antlers are actually composed of much more than just keratinized tissue. And that's all a horn is. A horn is just keratinized tissue. That's all it is. So,
keratinized tissue being?
Hair, basically. Really finely compressed hair. That's what a rhino's horn is made of.
Like your fingernails, right?
Are fingernails keratin in the same sort of structure as a horn is?
From my understanding, they are.
They are? Okay, cool.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so yeah, a rhino's horn is essentially just compressed hair. But antlers are organs. They're comprised of skin, nerves, blood vessels, fibers, a cartilage, bone. So that's why I say they're the fastest growing organs in the world, because they are actually an organ. So what any cervid, so deers, moose, other types of small deer-like creatures as well.
Please.
Mises, if you're talking about different species of mice, of which there are none, so I don't know why you would, but so a fully grown red deer can grow, I think red deer are called elk in the US. So a fully grown red deer or elk is about 200 kilos, and they grow 30 kilo antlers in just 3 months. So it's an insanely fast growth process. Growth of the antler is triggered by hormone fluctuations. So once testosterone starts building up before mating season, the horns will start to form. The antlers will start to form. And once testosterone starts dropping off, the tissue that's connected to the antlers at the base of them will start eroding away and eventually break off. So if you can, for instance, artificially precipitate a drop in testosterone. So if you castrate a stag, for instance, testosterone will drop and the antlers will shed or cast or just drop off earlier. And really weird thing is that if the tissue from which antlers normally erupts, there's a fancy name for it, I can't remember exactly what it is, but if you transplant that tissue to another part of a body of a cervid, it will start growing a weird sort of antler formation in that part of the body. So you can cause antlers to occur. I think the experiment that they did in the 60s caused antlers to grow on the metacarpal bone of a deer.
That sounds horrendous.
Yeah, it's really fucking weird. I'm assuming you can't get ethical permission to do that sort of shit anymore.
No, I mean, you can't be making Wolverine deer, well, you know, haphazardly. Yeah.
Is this where the jackalope came from?
Probably.
Quite possibly, yeah. Put some deer tissue on the head of a hare. It is a really bloody process as well. Like I said, there's skin on those things. It's commonly referred to as velvet. So when the antlers are done growing, they will start to shed this skin. And it's a really bloody process. Like, it's just, there's blood everywhere.
Looks metal as fuck.
Yeah, it really does. I've told this story before about Dr. André Grün-Ofstad, who was a guest on this podcast in season one or two or something like that. He was out tracking moose on an island just off the coast of Norway, and he was looking for it. He knew it was in the vicinity, but he just couldn't figure out where it was. His beeper was going mad, but he could not figure out where the moose was. And then it stood up about 30, 40 meters away from him. A full-grown bull moose with these massive antlers that had just shed their velvet. So they were dripping with blood, and he described it as a really, really scary experience, which, yeah, I mean...
I can't imagine.
Yeah,
that would be horrifying.
Yeah, and for moose and for deer, getting shit caught in your antlers is a really big problem. So, for instance, you see the face of the former owner of the body, the meth addict dad, has gotten stuck on the antlers, which would impair vision and, you know, have a really negative effect on that Wendigo's life. Turns out he's able to just, you know, peel it away with his hands, which begs the question, why did he not do that earlier? Why are you going for dramatic timing, you fucking weirdo? But...
because he's a Wendigo of class.
Yeah.
Scare tactics.
In the theater.
But yeah, it can be a real problem. So there was this haunting image of a red deer that had clearly gotten into a fight with another red deer and had won, and had not been able to extricate the other deer's head, the other deer's antlers, from its own antlers. So it was walking around with the decapitated head of its former foe stuck into its own antlers. Which is, not very helpful. Yeah, we do see deer that die, deer or moose that die all the time from getting their antlers stuck in something and not being able to get them free.
I feel like that's the deer's revenge, like the one who lost. He's like, all right, you won, but now I stare at you for eternity.
At what cost? I was reading a paper about the kind of the evolutionary significance and the bonuses that antlers convey, and the paper is cited that it's 5% of cervid mortalities are due to being locked with another cervid and then starving or dying of exhaustion, because once you're locked, you're fucked. That's just it.
Yeah,
you're easy prey for a predator come along, you know. And there's a story of moose getting locked and a bear just kind of having a nice 2-for-1, you know, little deal.
Yeah.
No, Sam, I don't know if you know this, but within the last like 5 years or so, it's become very popularized in the bodybuilding culture to ingest the velvet from the shedding of the deer antlers. Mm-hmm. It is protein packed.
So what, chickpeas? What the hell?
Sam, you have to remember, these are also the people, these are the same kind of logic, or logic, quote, and a similar type of culture that gets people to buy hundreds, if not thousands of dollars worth of camouflage equipment for animals that are colorblind. So,
yeah, as we've said before, you could dress up in bright orange and they wouldn't be able to see you properly.
In fact, it's recommended to dress up in bright orange when you're hunting for safety.
Yeah, that would make a lot more sense. Yeah.
Humans actually can't see something when it's camouflaged, so...
And, yeah, so Adam sent me a really interesting paper before we did this episode, because I'd always assumed that the antlers and the size of antlers was entirely a product of sexual selection. Sexual selection being something that's not particularly practical in everyday life, but it helps get, you know, the females of the species into bed with you, so to speak.
Yes.
But it's not 100% that. Apparently, there are some evolutionary advantages in terms of fighting off predators. So, the study that Adam sent through was elk, which, hang on, I'm going to check this because it's always fucking pissed me off. I'm pretty sure elk is red deer.
I think they might be different.
No, it's not. Yeah, so elk or the wapiti. Wapiti? Wapiti? I don't know.
I've never heard wapiti.
Yeah, well, oh, that's right. I always get fucking confused with these guys because, elg is the Norwegian word for moose. Yeah, and when, Europeans went over to North America, they called these things elk because they thought they looked exactly the same as moose, but they're not, so fucking confusing.
They look a thing like moose. What the fuck are they talking about?
It's just a big cervid with big antlers, so they're just like, oh, it's
there are moose here. Or, sorry, here, there, in North America.
Yeah. It's odd. I don't know. Anyway.
But yeah, like, using it as an anti-predator deterrent.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that can cause certain elk to hang on to their antlers long after they're useful in terms of mating because it helps them fend off predators, which is, yeah, really interesting. I'd always assumed it was just sexual selection.
Yeah, and there's a really interesting trade-off there, too, with the sexual selection angle because those elk that drop their antlers earlier, they are able to start rebuilding the new set sooner, and they can then get bigger and more impressive. But it leaves them open to predators for a bit longer than the ones that are better protected, so their immortality increases as a result, or at least it's correlated with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but it's interesting to have this on, like, a predatory creature, because I feel like in other depictions I've seen of the Wendigo in popular culture, it's just, you know, a lanky human or maybe a deer-looking monster, but you just see it have fangs and claws. But this creature is actually, like, using its antlers to fucking gore the shit out of people to kill them before it starts consuming them, which I thought was a really cool little, like, actual usefulness of its anatomy, and it was cool seeing that.
Yeah, so something that originally developed for defense, but this animal has turned into a carnivore somewhere along the line, and they're used as a form of attack now, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's there are a couple of species of cervid that are omnivorous, but they're mainly smaller ones, I think, that feed on, like, insects and small lizards and that sort of thing.
That would be my guess, because usually, I mean, there are large carnivores out there, but the truly large meat eaters are those that eat a shit ton of smaller things, i.e. whales. But when you have a very large land organism, most of them tend to be herbivores, just because you need just the sheer amount of food you need to consume to get that big. It's hard to get that with meat.
There are lots of species, and we've talked about this before, there are lots of species that we traditionally think of as herbivores, but that will consume meat on a semi-regular basis. So pigs, for instance, we even talked about armadillos.
Oh, pigs are straight omnivores.
Yeah, 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 but they will, they'll like hunt down and kill different species.
Gotcha.
Yeah. We talked about the Galapagos giant turtle.
Mm-hmm, eating the bird, right?
Yeah, what's the species? It's a tortoise.
The Galapagos giant tortoise.
Giant tortoise, yeah, that was hunting down that bird. Yeah, so there's lots of species that do this, but to the best of my knowledge, there aren't any cervids that are omnivorous on anything larger than small insects or anything like that.
Yeah, it would be a pretty wild evolutionary pathway to get, or maybe, I mean, this could be an example of convergent evolution where you have a very disrelated organism that ends up looking kind of like a deer. Maybe it has the mutations or the same kind of, mutations popped up in its population to have that antler set up, and it became selected for over time, so it became fixed in the population.
Yeah.
But as far as having this kind of bipedal, kind of quadruped organism that is a straight-up carnivore, a ravenous one at that, having never been seen before, is very hard to kind of explain away. But I love it as a creature design.
Oh, yeah, it looked brilliant. So, yeah, I'm all for convergent evolution in that, you know, a different kind of species has just grown antler-looking features. I mean, they could be horns, for all we know, in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, you could, for a fun example of convergent evolution, you could have, there's an organism here called a rock hyrax. I don't know, for those of you that aren't familiar with them, look them up. They kind of look like a big, like a rodent, kind of like a rabbit, or like a big rat rabbit had a baby or something like that.
Mm.
But their closest relative is actually the elephant. Like, they're just a very unique organism that happens to just kind of look like other, like small rodents, even though it's not.
Technically, they're herbivores, but cows have been known to chew on the carcasses of other dead animals. In Australia, that often means dead kangaroos.
Hey, everybody, quick disclaimer for the story section. Both myself, Libby, and Sam are all secondhand consumers of Wendigo folklore and the indigenous history beyond this monster, behind this monster in general. We do not pretend to be experts. None of us are indigenous peoples ourselves. So we just want to put this little disclaimer up top that although we enjoy this folklore, we are not experts and we apologize for any inaccuracies we might be conveying.
Yeah.
And please let us know what inaccuracies we did convey.
Yeah.
Yes, please. I'd love to hear about it.
For the story section this week, we'll talk about sort of the mythos behind the Wendigo. So the Wendigo is actually part of the traditional belief system of the Algonquin-speaking First Nations people. So the First Nations people, for those of you who don't know, are the Indigenous Canadians. So the Wendigo is often portrayed as we've said before, cannibalistic, supernatural. There's some versions where it's kind of like a deity, some versions where it's more of a demon. And they were strongly associated with anything to do with winter. So that being cold, starvation, famine, but also greed. So it's kind of the embodiment of excess and greed, as it is often never satisfied, killing and consuming a person and constantly searching for new victims. And we see this in the anatomy of it, as it's usually, as we talked about earlier in the podcast, it's illustrated as emaciated, just very desiccated, tight skin pulled over its bones, with bones pushing out, which could be maybe even what the antlers are, just bones pushing out of its emaciated head.
Like a bigger golem.
Yeah, exactly. Like a bigger golem. And then, you know, skin is death gray, and usually, much like the movie did convey, eerie odor of decay and decomposition. So sort of like if greed had a smell, that's what it would be.
I like that.
Yeah. So the reason that this is part of the storytelling belief system of the Algonquin-speaking people is they used it as a fable to sort of overturn greed, like I said earlier, but it encouraged cooperation and moderation during those harsh winter times. So a lot of early, you know, peoples often resorted to cannibalism to survive. But as we know with humans, we, due to our intelligence, have sort of created, you know, what we consider to be a soul or morals, that kind of thing that most animals don't have. So they used this fable to deter people from eating other people, which I found very fascinating.
Yeah.
Adam, did you want to add any more to that, by the way?
One of the things that I, from my understanding of the Wendigo folklore, because when I first heard about this, I thought it was fascinating and I did a bunch of research on it, is that it's a big taboo amongst the First Nations people. It's not something you speak about or even bring up for fear of attracting its attention or potentially, mm-hmm. you know, manifesting it more or less.
Yeah, it definitely can be like the boogeyman, so to speak.
I think the only other thing I want to touch on is that the movie kind of did an interesting take on the folklore where, from my understanding, there's two different versions of this, but I think the primary version of the Wendigo, or the primary like source, comes from somebody engaging in cannibalism, and that then inviting the Wendigo spirit into them, and then they become this emaciated, horrendous creature.
Okay.
Where the Wendigo isn't actually the monster that you see, it is the spirit possessing what used to be a person. So in a video game that Libby and I played a little while back, Until Dawn. If you have any interest in playing that, I recommend playing it now. Don't listen to what I'm saying next.
Super fun story based game. Very choose your own adventure.
Yeah, literally choose your own adventure. Libby and I fucked it. We got some people killed. But anyway, that game revolves around this Wendigo folklore. And this kind of comes about because two people unfortunately end up trapped in a cave. And one of them dies, but the other one, to survive, eats the one who died. And she then, because they're it's set, I believe, in the area where the Algonquin people were originally, and she attracts the spirit of the Wendigo, it possesses her, she becomes this horrendous monster. And you see another individual do that as well towards the end of the game, where he's become trapped in the cave, actually played by Rami Malek. That's one of the first times I saw him outside of the movies. He was a character in this game. And he also engages in cannibalism and becomes infected, quote, infected by the spirit, and starts to transform into a monster himself as well. But there's other versions of the story where you can catch it from another Wendigo. It doesn't necessarily have to be, or you can just be possessed straight up by the spirit. You don't necessarily need to engage in those like greed acts like Libby was talking about, or specifically cannibalism.
Yeah. And this is for a monster that's, I guess we would consider a little more obscure. It has popped up a lot recently. If anybody's watched the TV show Hannibal, there are constant appearances of a Wendigo-like creature in the mind of Will Graham. There is a Wendigo-like creature that appears constantly in the mind of Will Graham that's really kind of haunting. Like, they're not even jump scares, but they freak the crap out of me every time the Wendigo pops up and that sort of thing.
It's interesting, though, with that recent surge in pop culture where you identify it as a Wendigo, but from my understanding, the whole like deer antlered motif is a very recent thing, and traditionally there wasn't much of a description for what the Wendigo was beyond a very emaciated and gray and deathly like human, as Libby was describing them.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, because that was my first experience with it, minus the antlers, when I saw it in, I think, one of the most early episodes of Supernatural, back when I used to watch that show. It was a man who, had consumed human flesh and had turned into the Wendigo. So that was the first time I came across that sort of creature. It's also in the recent Pet Sematary movie. It's never seen, but it is, I think, credited with being responsible for the resurrections of the beings who are resurrected in the old Indian burial ground. They say Indian burial ground, but I guess you would say Native American burial ground, right?
Indigenous, yeah.
There is also, and this is one of my favorites because I've seen it in a bunch of these cartoons, there's a Marvel villain called the Wendigo.
Yeah.
Kind of like a big white wolf-looking monster best of my memory.
A Bigfoot-looking monster.
Yeah. Often battles the Hulk or Wolverine. I think the first appearance. Yeah, was the Hulk versus Wolverine is when the Wendigo showed up for the first time. So
it was the Hulk versus the Wendigo, and Wolverine shows up.
Ah, okay, right.
Also, one of the earliest published novellas featuring the Wendigo is actually titled The Wendigo by Algernon Blackwood, and it was first published in 1910.
Fantastic story, if you ever get a chance. The Tales to Terrify podcast, which published one of Libby's works earlier this year, has a narration on one of their earlier episodes, and it is a really, really well done job of that story.
I appreciate that shout out, by the way.
Absolutely. It's well-deserved. It's a great story.
So I just briefly wanted to go over the difference between a fable and a parable. I know we hear a lot of that in storytelling, and there is actually a difference. They're not interchangeable. So the Wendigo is actually a First Nations fable, very specific. A fable is a literary genre. Is often a succinct fictional story that features animals, legendary creatures, plants, inanimate objects, or forces of nature that are anthropomorphized that illustrate or lead to a particular moral lesson, kind of like i.e. Aesop's fables. But a parable is the same exact thing without the animals, legendary creatures, plants, or inanimate objects, or forces of nature. So basically, both parables and fables are short stories that contain moral lessons for the readers, but whereas parables contain human characters only, fables are known to have talking animals, plants, or supernatural forces, hence the Wendigo. Yeah, and fables are often set in an imaginary world, whereas parables have very real humans facing the real world problems. And parables often, not always, but often have spiritual or religious connotations. Popular fables would be like the tortoise and the hare, whereas popular parables are the Good Samaritan or the prodigal son. Okay. But one of the popular secular parables is the Emperor's New Clothes.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because the supernatural aspect of a fable made me like think like, okay, is the Bible most, or the Christian Bible mostly fables? But then the religious or spiritual aspect obviously makes me think parables. But there's also animals that do like crazy stuff in the Bible. So do you happen to know which one it would be?
They are mostly parables, and it's very specific because the animals themselves aren't talking or taking on anthropomorphized features. So, you know, like, for example, in the tortoise and the hare, how they're having this race and they're talking to each other. That's very human, right? Like, real tortoises and real hares can't speak to each other, and they certainly can't challenge each other to a race. But whereas, say, let's take a more fantastical Bible story like Jonah and the whale. That's still a parable because even though it is a bit fantastical, the whale isn't sitting there talking to Jonah while it's in his belly and telling him all the shit that he's done wrong in his life and why he's been swallowed up and having this full-fledged conversation. He's just a whale doing whale things. He just happens to swallow a dude.
So, do we feel bad for the monster this week?
I do.
You do?
Oh, I absolutely do.
Really? Is it just an evil spiritual entity moving between things?
Well, I mean, I guess that's how you define the monster. To me, the monster in the movie is the dad and the son, right? They're the ones doing the killing.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. In that case, I agree with you 100%. I feel very, especially because, you know, he realizes what's happening to him and he tries to keep people safe from himself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So does Lucas in his own way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that I feel bad for them for sure. And also the poor, befuddled Jesse Plemons, Sheriff Jesse Plemons,
put upon.
His like partner be like, how do you explain this? He's like, man, I don't fucking know. This person's been eaten half to death. Like, this guy's missing his legs. Like, what do you want me to tell you?
If there was one word that I would attribute to him, it would be sigh. Yes. His life is just one long...
mine would be harumph.
Yeah, harumph.
That's pretty good. Also, why does my sister have such a hero complex? Come on.
Yeah. Okay, but would we recommend this movie?
Nah.
I would. I think this was a movie that I've been looking forward to for about a year and a half now, and although the ending disappointed me a bit, and I think I worry about a bit of cultural whitewashing and appropriation going on with a primarily white cast, and I believe white production and directing staff. Mm-hmm. All in all, I did enjoy this movie, and I thought the monster was fast. It was like a really, really cool design, and I love the setting.
Yeah. I think its saving grace is that it's short. So but it's still, it's so by the numbers. I do think the creature's cool, but I can't remember what it was. There was a film earlier in the year where Libby, I think it might have even been Annihilation, where Libby said, like, as soon as you started watching the movie, you knew how it was going to end. And for me, this was exactly the same thing. Yeah, I can't really recommend this movie. No.
Yeah, I'm a firm no. I think this movie is very slow, it's a trudge, and very little payoff.
Next week, we're doing Hellboy.
Oh, fuck yes. Which one?
It just says Hellboy, so okay, I'm guessing the original.
The Hellboy.
And by Hellboy, we mean, of course, Ron Perlman.
Yes. I think said it was the second one, right?
The second one, because it's got it's got the tooth fairies in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got to be Hellboy 2. So yeah, next week, Hellboy 2, The Golden Army. We can talk about Abe Sapien, a.k.a. Guillermo del Toro's prototype for Lady Fucks a Fish Guy, which is still fucking weird. People, it's weird. She's fucking an animal. Anyway.
So strange.
It's so strange. But, as we say here at the end of every episode, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye-bye.
And don't eat your neighbor.
This is what was in the mine. It's a diabolical spirit.
Excuse me, this is a myth.
For you, yeah.
He's here.